I'd like now to welcome Trish Kenny. She's the author of the book Silver Platter Girl, and she will be reading from her book at Collected Works Bookstore as a benefit for the Santa Fe Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center on Friday, July 31st at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
Thank you so much. This is a very intense book about healing from childhood sexual abuse, and I find it a kind of a fascinating, if sometimes difficult, to go along with you on journey, because one of the things that's so difficult is that when you figure out what actually happened, that's only the beginning of the journey. Figuring out what happened and confronting parents, perpetrators, and so on doesn't result in instant healing. It's a very long process.
That is so absolutely true and very intuitive of you to figure out so quickly. My book is my way of finishing a very long process, as you say, of completely ridding myself of the ramifications and residue of being raised in a sexually abusive environment. One in four of us have some type of sexual abuse in our history, and it causes a lot of trouble. And it takes a long time to figure out what happened and what kind of trouble it's actually causing. In my case, I spent years trying to find more traditional ways of getting rid of it because I didn't want it in my life. I was in a relentless pursuit of living without that residue. And for me, it ended up being a physical disease.
So in your case, and this is another thing that's very interesting about the book, the pain and real suffering and trauma that you experienced and that you were having a hard time getting rid of, in some kind of alchemical way, at least in your view, transformed itself into a cancerous tumor, and the healing of that tumor was analogous to or identical with the healing of the trauma.
Absolutely, and that is my story. And I understand that some people find it difficult to believe maybe from a scientific point of view, and actually there is science now that would lead you to believe that the medical community is starting to understand and accept this a little bit more. But for me, it was not so much the actual abuse, which in my case was not severe or lifelong, but it was the adult ramifications of that abuse that became so difficult to manage. And in my case, I had a very successful outward life, very happy, vibrant marriage and a very successful career. And I had a secret life, and this is the life that I had learned was, you know, so important and so powerful to a woman from my father. And I had a relationship in that secret life that was very destructive. It was not actually an affair. It was just a sort of an addiction to feeling desired in that way. And I continued to indulge in it, even though it was literally destroying me. And when it finally reached a point where it just couldn't continue anymore, after a fairly traumatic experience with that person, 3 days later, I had a tumor in my right breast that I could see. Didn't take a mammogram to find. And I believe that all of that stress that had finally reached that ultimate climax, that I put it all into that tumor. And I know that when it was removed, I felt immediate relief. When I was diagnosed, I felt immediate relief. I felt I was getting sick to get well. Now, I didn't realize how sick I was getting, and I ended up with a bone marrow transplant, which for me was an incredible transformational rebirth. And I think that is the moment when I realized that I was going to have the very unusual opportunity to have a dramatic, almost instantaneous healing in a sterile room. And that's what happened to me.
I think it's important to talk about the reality for sexual abuse survivors that it's not just about rape, and it's not even just about physical touch. It's as much about the attitude in the house, the sort of, you describe it very well in a kind of horrifying way, the lascivious kind of Playboy magazine attitude that was going on, and the denial of it, and the complicity of the other parent, in your case, the mother, in what was happening.
Yes, and I think that it's very important. When I first realized all of a sudden what the truth was in my family, it was from listening to Oprah Winfrey when she was this was in the late 70s, when she was first coming out about her sexual abuse. And ironically, the part of the program that really stayed with me was that it didn't have to be rape. It could be the way that you were looked at, the way that you were touched that made you uncomfortable, or a way that you felt sexualized. And that's what gave me the courage to say, this is what's wrong with me, and this is what's wrong with my family. Because I believed that even though I had been molested by my father, that, you know, that didn't rise to the level of something I could really make a case for, or that could possibly cause all of these problems that I was having. But I believed Oprah when she said it didn't have to be rape. And I immediately confronted my father by letter. And I immediately called my sister and said, oh, my gosh, I figured it out. And that was when I first began to realize that my sister had been sexually abused by my father throughout her entire life.
What's interesting reading your book is that the writing is on the wall the whole time, but, of course, children and even young adults don't know how to recognize it.
Exactly. I mean, as a child, you really don't have a choice. You believe that your family is a normal family. Even if you feel conflicted and confused, those are your parents. And in the case of it being a close family member. And 83%, I believe it is, of childhood sexual abuse comes from a close family member. And it's also the least reported for obvious reasons. It's very hard to tell on one of your parents, especially when, you know, the entire family revolves around that type of activity and that type of the way we see things. So, but I think it changes when you get to be an adult, because then your behaviors are more under your control. Now, I shouldn't say that exactly, because we develop addictions, which are very hard to control. But at least you're not living in that household and have no ability to, figure out what's happening to you. As an adult, you begin to have a choice. And even though it's very hard for abuse victims to realize that they have a choice, because that's part of what abuse is a lot of control and secrecy. But if you can figure that out, then that's the beginning. If you can tell someone, if you can begin to look at the truth yourself, and decide that you really want to get out of the clutches of that entire situation, that's when I believe healing begins. And that's why I decided to, after being well from my disease for 12 years, I decided that I wasn't finished. That, you know, I used to give keynote speeches about my remarkable recovery from cancer, and I would link it to trauma, but I wouldn't say what the trauma was. And I finally decided that was wrong, that I needed to tell the whole story, because if I couldn't tell the story as well as I had gotten, then how could you expect anyone who wasn't as fortunate as me to begin to tell their story?
How did your family respond to the publication of the book? Your sister, who also went, you know, lived in the same family and experienced some of the same things that you did, responded in a very different way, as you describe in the book. She got into bad marriages and had a life that on the surface was falling apart, whereas yours on the surface was very together. Then you wrote this book. How did your sister respond to it? How did your parents respond to it?
Well, I think this is the most complicated part of any interview that I do, because it's difficult for people to understand. But I don't have an active relationship with my parents anymore. My parents still do not accept what happened in our family. They don't want to talk about it. They don't love the truth as much as I do. My mother still lives in a great deal of denial. So I don't really have an active relationship with them. And as far as I know, they aren't even aware that the book's been published or that I've written the book. And I'm okay with that. They will find out, and I will tell them, and I will let them know. But I don't see them, and I don't speak with them. So, you know, I do have a very lightweight writing relationship with them, you know, mostly holiday cards and that type of thing. But as far as my sister goes, her life is very difficult. She hasn't worked in many years. She has a lot of health problems, as many sexual abuse survivors do. She has a lot of emotional and mental health issues. and she's pretty much a shut-in in her small home, and she is still very, very deeply involved with my parents. And the reason for that, I believe, is that, you know, she was taught from a very early age that their needs were more important than hers. And that's a lesson that she learned very, very well. And, for example, they're having their 60th wedding anniversary next week, and the only guest at the anniversary is my sister. I have, even though I dedicated the book to her, she's been undergoing, you know, some surgeries and some difficult problems, and I have yet to sit down and talk to her about it. And I, you know, I'm concerned because it will be difficult for her to understand what I've done and why.
Another thing that struck me about the book was that while the abuse was specific to your family, there is a tone to the sexualization in the family that is cultural and that is not specific to your family. In other words, the kind of, there's a scene early in the book where you and your sister are posing as if you were Playboy bunnies, and your mother is unhappy that your father has left these magazines around for you to find, and he's delighted. And that moment struck me as something that is kind of a more large-scale cultural disease, so that even those people who are not directly affected by an individual are kind of affected by that ethos.
And I agree with you completely. My father kept the magazines around, and it wouldn't surprise me if he didn't try and hide them very well. He probably wanted us to see them. But I don't think that the part about little girls, you know, seeing those kinds of magazines and then pretending to be the models in the magazine is probably that uncommon. What I found uncommon about it, even at my young age at the time, was that my father was looking at us in a way that was chilling. My father was titillated by the experience. And that's what made my household sexually abusive, is that he was looking at it sexually, looking at us sexually. It excited him. And I don't necessarily mean that, you know, he wanted to molest us at that moment. What I mean is that exactly what you're saying, he was excited at the notion that we had found the naked pictures and we were posing naked. And that was, I agree, it was a cultural kind of thing. However, you have to add that my father was an Air Force fighter pilot. And I actually did a radio interview a few days ago with a woman, and she told me that, you know, after all, he was a fighter pilot. And I said, well, you know, that's the excuse my father used to use, is that he was a fighter pilot, and that's just the way fighter pilots are. And I told the host that I didn't believe that was an excuse, and she said, well, it's not an excuse, it's a style. So that's a cultural thing to me as well, you know, that there's a type of man who we can excuse this behavior from because it's kind of part of the culture of fighter pilots. That's unacceptable.
Well, not only that, but the culture of fighter pilots or the culture of the military sexualizing women in that way leads to a lot of much larger problems that have to do with rape, torture, militarism, and colonial exploitation of other people. I mean, it doesn't stay in the family.
Well, my father once told me that there was no such thing as rape, because all women wanted sex all the time, therefore it was always consensual. And that was also part of, you know, my sister and I had that kind of upbringing, that we were told that women could use their sexuality for power, and that's how they would control men, and that's how they would get ahead in business, and the Playboy generation was a great place to be, and that we should take full advantage of it. So I agree with you. These were very much my father's perception of the 60s and the culture that was changing. And he was very jealous that we were being allowed to live in that kind of society before we made permanent decisions like getting married.
Well, unfortunately, we were out of time. But if people would like to continue the conversation, Trish Kenny, author of the book Silver Platter Girl, will be reading at Collected Works Bookstore as a benefit for the Santa Fe Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center on Friday, tomorrow, July 31st at 6 in the evening. Trish, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web 24/7 at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email address radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can listen to the show if you missed it in the morning on the podcast site, santafe.radiocafe.org. It's there thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services of Santa Fe. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents the final survey of July Artists of the Month, Ruby Braff, Ralph Sutton, and Paul Smith. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Robert Knott will be here, and much, much more. Ciao.